Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD, iHeart, or wherever you downloaded us from. Thanks very much for doing that. We have a wonderful guest for you. This is 1039B. The B's are always the guest segment of the week. It is Brett Stetka, S-T-E-T-K-A, who's author of a fascinating book. I want to read this book. I hope you do too. History of the Human Brain. As I said to him, normally I get to read the book before the interview. I didn't receive this book. One of the rare times in this 20 years of doing interviews on You, the Owner's Manual, I have not gotten to read the book beforehand, but hopefully you'll enjoy this. We, of course, are brought to you as usual, both the A and the B segment, by Persona Nutrition, My Persona. You can get supplements personalized just to you. Can you imagine that? Just personalized to you based on your diet and your needs. Nothing extra, nothing too much, nothing too little. And maybe you won't need anything. That's the joy of taking the free assessment at mypersona.com. And you can talk to a nutritionist as well and say, I really don't want that in a pill form. How do I get it as in food? They'll tell you because that's what they like to do. Mypersona.com. Brett Stetka, who wrote A History of the Human Brain, is a physician who is the editorial director of Medscape, which is really the professional division of WebMD. He's a non-practicing physician, but freelance health and science journalist for a variety of print and online publications. But actually, he did graduate from a medical school. So let's first find out how he decided to go into writing. Brett, thanks very much for coming on the show. And the history of the human brain, just the abstract that I got, which is not small.
Yeah, well, Michael, thank you, first of all. And, you know, as I believe you're a fellow MD, so I was wondering if we'd talk about how I took this strange path into medical journalism. So I graduated medical school from the University of Virginia, UVA, in 2005, and I didn't enter the match on purpose because I really did love all the neuroscience research I did well in medical school. So my plan had been to maybe tack on a PhD into an MD-PhD program, and so I entered a postdoc year at Mount Sinai up in Manhattan, researching the effects of red wine on mouse Alzheimer's, a mouse model of Alzheimer's disease. And to be honest, the head of the lab was Italian and didn't speak very much English. So I had to write all the papers. And I ended up loving writing about the science because, you know, I've always had a creative streak. I've played music my whole life. And so really just to make a living, I applied for some jobs as a health journalist and got a job at MD, and I just really loved it and somehow turned that into a writing career. I ended up writing about food for various places in New York and then got an NPR and Scientific American column on health and science. And, you know, for the first 5 years, I assumed I was going to go back to either the match or to the lab, most likely. But you know, I was making a living and loving it, and now it's 15 years later. So here we are.
And we're the real beneficiaries of it. I should tell people who don't know Medscape, which, as we said, is the professional division of WebMD.com. It's a really great site. This book is available from Workman.com. And you've got a fascination with the sponge. And how does that fascination with the sponge lead to the development of the human brain?
Sure, this was something I had no idea about when I started writing this book. You know, my point was to trace the evolution of the brain back as far as I could based on the science that's out there. And as it turns out, the genetic data and fossil records show that the sea sponge, the same sponge that we've used for, you know, millennia to clean ourselves, and that you can still buy at Target, you know, an actual sponge, it was probably the first animal to evolve on Earth around 700 million years ago. And if you look at the cells, and there's plenty of studies on this if you Google it, but they're somewhat buried. It's kind of arcane knowledge. The cells of a sea sponge communicate much in the same way as our brain cells or our neurons. They use electrical currents to communicate and release many of the same neurotransmitters that our brain cells do. I believe they use GABA and norepinephrine, a lot of just the same chemicals. So in doing this research, I really, you know, it really seems like the brain can be traced back to this ancient little bleb that, you know, bobs on the seafloor to this day, and that, you know, makes for an adequate, you know, armpit scrubber, if you will.
Now, one of the theses, or at least I take it as one of the theses in the book, is that it really was, for the longest time, that man was facing extinction until something happened that differentiated man from other species, other animals. And one, give us a little hint of how did we go from the sea sponge to, I guess, the apes to ourselves? And will the, and what, and I've got another weird question on that. Will the apes become us sooner or later?
That's an interesting question. So the quick version of how we got to, say, apes is eventually you get marine worms, you get fish, amphibians evolve into reptiles, and then reptiles basically, once we're on land, split off into, you know, most of what we see on land today, you know, modern reptiles, lizards, you know, birds, formerly dinosaurs, and then mammals. And eventually, about 66 million years ago, after the dinosaurs died, primates kind of came into their own, and you get monkeys. And then about 25 million years ago, you get apes, which, you know, we are one. And so if you fast forward to the past 2 million years, as our brain really came into its own, a lot of it had to do with us being adaptable and intelligent. There was selection in the biological Darwinian sense for us to have a bigger and more complex brain, simply because shifting climates in Africa dried things out, so we couldn't live in the trees as we had done, you know, as our chimpanzee cousins still do often. So we were out in the savanna, going up against, you know, lions and saber-toothed cats. So we were not the strongest. We weren't the fastest. We were certainly not on the top of the food chain like we are today due to our big brains. So there was selection for increasingly savvy brains and skills and traits and talents. And that's how we ended up with tool making and weapon making and fire and hunting and all of the sort of the creative pursuits that define our species. Could it have happened in the chimp lineage? We share a common ancestor with chimpanzees and bonobos from about 7 million years ago, and our lineage is split. They've both evolved for 7 million years since then, as have we. They certainly could have, you know, taken over the planet like we have, but there wasn't as much pressure for them in terms of cognition and mental abilities. They were doing okay, and presumably we weren't, and for better or for worse, that's why we've taken over things.
So it was basically when given lemons make lemonade, when we were slow, and not only slow but not strong enough, we developed our brains to survive. Is that correct? Is that the hypothesis? And then will apes and chimpanzees or other animals, are they gradually increasing their intelligence to help them survive, or is there no other development like this evolutionarily?
I think if you took humans out of the equation and the cultural impact that we have on every other species, certainly there would still be selection occurring in, say, a chimpanzee species for increased intelligence. You know, but for the most part, all the other apes are relatively endangered, you know, because of us. And I do think our cultural encroachment on these communities, and our cultural encroachment on ourselves, like culture is just whizzing by any sort of biological evolution or natural selection, which is certainly occurring. But I think that before we would even notice you know, chimpanzees evolving in any sort of way, at least in terms of cognitive capacity. I think human culture will either have extincted them or brought them back in zoos or preserves to a point where we're still in control, sort of the dark side of humanity. But yeah, I think in theory that could happen. It certainly could have happened with the intelligent sea mammals, orcas and certain porpoises, you know, in another redo of the natural history of the world. Perhaps civilization could have taken place underwater, since, you know, these animals are incredibly intelligent. But yeah, we happen to be the ones, due to these selective pressures, you know, in order to survive, that happen to win out, you know, as it were, if you consider it winning out, whatever we've done to the world.
And how close to extinction did we get?
Some people think incredibly close, down to a couple hundred, or in the hundreds of Homo sapiens on Earth within probably 100 to 200,000 years ago. That is debated, and some people think that those claims refer to just a single population of Homo sapiens in southeastern Africa that interestingly probably survived by learning how to track tides and shuck oysters and mussels, and hence shellfish is a big part of at least some of our ancestry. But what is known for sure is that about a million years ago, so this is, you know, one of our ancestors were called Homo erectus, very similar to us. They were upright, pretty big brains. They dwindled down to about 18,000 in population. So effective population, meaning those that could reproduce and pass on their genes. So about less than 20,000. And there's a lot of these are called population bottlenecks, where species numbers dwindle to the point where they're in danger. And there's probably three or four documented ones over the last million years, one about 70,000 years ago due to a volcanic eruption in Southeast Asia. And again, there's one about 125 to 150,000 years ago, and then the one a million years ago. So we get through these because our brain, by that point, is pretty advanced, by far the most advanced complex brain on the planet, even by a million years ago. You know, nothing can really touch us except other human species. And you know, there were a lot of us. There were up to 9 human species at one time on the planet. But that's, you know, that's what saved us. That's what the researchers think, is we were able to adapt to changing climate and these population bottlenecks by adapting, being creative, finding food, and building tools and building fire.
Are we outsmarting ourselves now? That is Brett, and we're talking to Brett Stetka, Stetka, a physician who is editorial director at Medscape, a regular contributor to NPR and Scientific American, about his book, The History of the Brain. And the title is fascinating, as well as the writing. I've only seen abstracts, but it is really tremendous. Are we at risk of extincting ourselves through making robots or too much intelligence and maybe too much technology? Or how do you think this will happen? Will we evolve to continue? What's your bet?
That's a great question. I think one a lot of people are wondering about. It does appear that natural selection in the biological sense is still happening, albeit on a very slow pace compared to how fast our culture is moving forward. So yes, I think there will be biological change, but more immediately, as you mentioned, artificial intelligence, genetic engineering technologies like CRISPR that can literally artificially evolve our genomes in the interest of curing a disease, or in a more worrisome fashion, you know, inserting a desirable trait into an embryo or to a child. So I think we're going to see change. I think that the way we communicate now, certainly the younger folks with digital communication and the constant texting and social media, is going to change our collective psychological state and the way we interact. But I do think that whatever becomes of us is going to be more of a cultural phenomenon, because the biology does move relatively slowly. So is it going to be AI? Do we accidentally build a machine that can feel something? And is a machine ever capable of feeling something? This is the famous computer scientist Alan Turing proposed the test. Can a machine ever you know, behave like a human? And is that real? Will it actually feel pain or love or hate and all the emotions that we feel? And that's somewhat scary. A lot of computer scientists and philosophers are warning against never creating real emotional states in machines. And how would we know if they're feeling pain? Like, so there's a, I feel like we can't really answer that at this point. I think all of these technologies should just move forward with caution. But I do think that they will outpace any real biological change to our brains, and we're going to be stuck with this 2-million-year-old organ dealing with this massive onslaught of new digital information.
Now, let me go and ask you a question that's in my sphere. As you probably know, I'm a wellness physician, or both an internist and anesthesiologist, and one of the areas...
I did my research.
Good. One of the areas that is, to me, most interesting is how hard it is to get behavior change, especially when it comes to obesity. And we as a country are becoming, we've gone from whatever it is, 7% obesity in 1980 to 43%+ now. And it's causing a whole bunch of chronic diseases and disabilities, as well as dementia late in life. Will we figure out that is our brain capable of overcoming the reptilian part of it? That is our the rest of our brain capable, or is that reptilian part that we survived with, at least in the on the savannah, to know when to get the heck out of the way? Will that reptilian part dominate enough so that we still have the chronic diseases without that we have now?
That's a great question. I'm honestly curious what, you know, your opinion too as a wellness physician, because I like that you bring up the reptilian brain, because we're certainly programmed, you know, in terms of obesity, to go after as much sugar, as many calories, as much fat as we can in nature, because our ancestors only lived to be about 35, so diabetes wasn't a concern, and, you know, heart disease wasn't really a concern. So if you come across a patch of fruit, or you can hunt a gazelle and get all this fatty meat, like you eat it, you keep it for you and your family. And unfortunately, we're stuck with that. That's why we like, you know, Reese's peanut butter cups and Big Macs instead of broccoli. I do think that the way that our brains have evolved, we have this big prefrontal cortex, the area right beneath our foreheads, that is why we're able to, you know, reason and exhibit abstract thought and problem solving. And I think it is a battle between what you would call your neo-mammalian brain, these modern structures that do provide reason and inhibition. Like, we know we shouldn't eat that entire bag of Reese's peanut butter cups or whatever it may be. So it is a struggle, and I'm curious what you think, because I know that when you're dealing with something that's a habit that might be a vice or overeating or drugs or whatever it is, gambling, you are reinforcing these neural networks. There's a reward circuit in our brains, and the more you participate in an activity of any kind, you really solidify that circuit. You literally add more neuronal connections or synapses. And so it can take a lot to undo a behavior that's hardwired like that. But I know that there are techniques like biofeedback, various, you know, counseling techniques, psychotherapy techniques, where you can overcome those and you can literally see physical changes in the brain. But yeah, I'm curious, as a wellness physician, do you have any approaches that you believe are effective for that?
We have approaches that are effective. A lot of it relates to socialization, the culture of a group, and the culture in a buddy system. But let me go and say, I don't think what you find with that is it's a very intensive process. What I think will happen is and behavior change is so tough that I think what will end up happening is, well, if we have to wait 50 years the way we have with cigarettes, I think we're doomed as a society, if you will. And so I think what will happen before then, sometime probably in the next 10 years, is a technologic solution. And whether that is converting white fat into brown fat in a routine way, or whether that is somehow reprogramming some of our genes to change our functions of desire and eating, I think we'll get a technologic solution. And I like we're in this race with the vaccine and the virus mutating. I think we're in a race as well with chronic disease versus technology and which one can win. I have no doubt long term that technology will win and that we will figure out a way that gets rid of, just like we did with many of the childhood diseases and decreasing those, such as polio and smallpox and diarrhea with sanitation and vaccines, that we will get a technology and have for many of the chronic diseases, whether you call it stents or surgery or other treatments, the statins, et cetera, we will, in fact, get a technologic solution that gets us through chronic disease causing as many disabilities, and it will probably lead us to living much longer as well. And as you notice, the last real breakthrough we had was the chip, which allows us to live better in many ways. I think the next one will be this biologic longevity revolution, which will allow us to actually give us life and length of life without disability and be the next major change. It's a fascinating conversation.
Well, I was going to say that kind of relates to the subtitle of my book, CRISPR, the hot genetic engineering technology. And I believe that they are working on using CRISPR to address obesity, at least in mouse models, by using gene manipulation to turn white fat into brown fat. So that kind of speaks to what you're saying. There might be a biotechnological solution here for these chronic disorders.
That's exactly right. So I hope the history of the brain and where we're going meld together. We've been talking with Brett Stetka. Fascinating discussion. I would love to keep talking to you. Brett Stetka, who's the physician editorial director of Medscape, as well as a frequent contributor to NPR and Scientific American, what I would call a master writer, and as you heard, a deep knowledge of this field and of where we're going and of where we've been, which helps really teach us where we're going. I want to thank you for downloading us, for keeping us motivated. I like the fact that 50,000 of you do it every week, so thank you. It keeps me motivated. I want to thank Caitlin for great engineering and especially Persona Nutrition. You can go to My Persona to find supplements and vitamins personalized just to you and your diet. Whatever you need, they can provide, and what you don't need, they won't provide. MyPersona.com. It's a free online assessment. And by the way, you get to speak to a nutritionist for free as well. That's at MyPersona.com. We've been talking with Brett Stetka. You can find his book, History of the Human Brain, and the subtitle does involve CRISPR, but I think History of the Human Brain is enough to find it at Amazon or BN or hopefully your local bookstore or just at workman.com. Brett, thank you very much. Fascinating discussion. We'll be back next week again with another fascinating guest, as well as the latest medical news of the week and what it means to you. Thanks again.